the money, I'm very happy to have the opportunity to talk about Hopeless, because in the last 2 years, most of the time I'm talking about the art cylinders in film. Okay, today I'm just going to introduce some work we did by using these archives in Hopeless. And mainly this is my group in China, in ROP, Beijing. We have about altogether about 30 people. And also, for this particular work, we collaborated with the Wuyangqing group. Also, for single crystal samples, we got some samples from Zhenda Gu from Japan, from that. Also, the group ourselves also got a sample from the Takao Nagawa from TIP in Japan. And also, for the sample measurement characterization, we collaborated with Professor Chung Hien Zhao's group in LP to measure TC and other things. For theoretical inputs, we collaborated with Han Choi from Korea, also particularly Chandra Varma from EC Riff5. And in this talk, I just say, first of all, I'll give a brief introduction on the VV laser archives, just some latest developments. And I will give two examples to show that by using these archives, we can work on the neural gap and also into the synchronous transition. The announcement loop is the one. Also, then I'll talk about just the evolution of the neural kink and animal kink in physical 1-2. Because I plan to talk about this the third part, but I don't think I have time, I will just skip it. So in this RPS, as we all know, RPS, so far people like RPS because it can give us some very direct information on the electron structure. Mainly you can measure the electron states, that's energy, momentum, and spin directly. That's why people like it, and it's very direct way to measure these quantities. And I think the principle is very simple. You just shine light on the sample, electrons will come out, you measure electron activity angle, measure its number as a function of energy, you better to see this, you notice the parameters. So for a long time, people used the, mainly use the synchron light, synch radiation. I think maybe most of the time, people use the synchron radiation as a light source. Sometimes in the lab, you can also use some thing called a gas discharge lamp. Okay, if you don't have synchron, people can use this lamp to do the RPS. But then when I went back to China, okay, we started to use the third one. That's a VV laser to do the RPS. VV means vacuum ultraviolet laser. When the laser energy is higher than 6.5 eV, we call it a VV, just vacuum ultraviolet. Because below 6.5 eV, this laser can travel in air. But if the energy is higher than 6.5, it cannot travel in air. It will be absorbed. It has to travel in vacuum. That's why it's called a vacuum ultraviolet laser. And then this is a system I built by the end of 2006. Yeah, spent 2.5 years to build this system by using laser. And something particular for this system is that in order to get this VV laser, we can use a special crystal, just a nonlinear crystal. Mainly this crystal, the function of this crystal is that you have a primary laser shining on the crystal. Because it's a nonlinear crystal of the crystal, after passing through it, you can give some double frequency. Then you shine the laser with 3.5 eV, and after you pass through the crystal, you can get a 7 eV. So this is a very special nonlinear optical crystal, because among all the available nonlinear optical crystals, this is only one that can give us the energy, put energy higher than 10 eV. All the others will be below 6 eV. Okay, so that's why this is very special. Also, this is crystal special because so far it can only be produced in China, by one group in China. So also why I'm fortunate to collaborate with them to use this crystal to do our data test. So then people may ask, what is special? Why if you use laser, why would that be good or bad, let's say, but you compare with synchron? I think by using laser, we can really gain a lot. Particularly, we can increase the energy resolution a lot. Therefore, for a long time, people using synchron, we were dreaming someday we can achieve better than 1 millibar resolution. That's a long time dream for synchron. But even so far, it's very difficult to achieve 1 millibar synchron resolution. But by using laser, you can easily achieve better than 1 millibar resolution. So far, we can get a 0.36 millivolt. So I think by using laser, that's a good, really a good advantage to achieve super high resolution and resolution also, and resolution. Also, by using laser, because the photometry is lower, automatically you improve your luminosity resolution two or three times. Particularly, the laser is very strong. Laser can be 100 times or even 1,000 times stronger than thin film. So you have very strong light source. First, you can easily enhance your data acquisition efficiency, or you can reduce your time, or your data quality can be very high. This is very high. That's why it's also this very good part for the laser RFS. Particularly also for a long time, people worry about for RFS. People know it's good, but some people just argue, maybe the RFS is a sub-sensitive technique. If you're using thin film, usually people can measure only the top one or two layers of the sample. So then you can easily argue whether your surface, you measure from surface, can really represent your bulk property. So people for a long time trying to improve the bulk sensitivity of RFS system by going up, increasing the photometry. Actually, by lowering the photometry to 6 eV or 10 eV, you can really enhance the bulk sensitivity. So that's also another good advantage for the laser RFS. Of course, it has some limitations because we don't have the tunability as we have in thin film. Also, because the photometry is small, the momentum space we can cover is very smaller. So that's the disadvantage for the laser RFS. I think in this case, I think laser and thin film RFS are just complementary. They all have their own advantages and disadvantages. They don't kill each other. Okay. So this is just the lab we have now in IOP Beijing. At present, we have three systems working. This is the first one we built, okay, by the year 2006. Later, at the beginning, we have only one photometry, one laser. But later on, we just upgraded to have another laser which can tune the photometry between 5.9 and 7.1 eV. So this is a tunable laser. So this is upgraded. And then after this, we built another two RF system, laser system. This one is a spin resolved RFS. Now we can make a spin. Okay. Also, the third one is we call 2D momentum RF system. So these three systems are now all working. And actually, we're now making the fourth one. This one, just the main purpose is to really get a sample temperature below 1 Kelvin. Because we want to work on some systems which has low TC, like fermions. So this system is particularly made to really work on some fermion systems. So I just want to say a little bit more on the spin RFS system, because for spin RFS, of course, usual RFS, you only measure energy and the momentum. But for spin RFS, now you can only measure spin. So that's why you can get the complete measurement of three quantities. Okay. But for a long time, this technique, spin resolved RFS, has been around for a long time, but didn't think from. But the problem is that it suffers the problem of poor efficiency and a very poor energy resolution. And if you think from, so far the best energy resolution is about 50 to 100 microns, also with very low efficiency. But by using laser, actually we can achieve now the 2.5 millivolt resolution. Actually, that's the best so far in the world. Also, because you have laser, the photon flux is very high, you can easily enhance the efficiency by 100 times or 1,000 times. So that's why by using laser, we really can make this laser spin RFS to work in a very good way. So by using this system, actually, we already did some work on the spin on the topological insulator, because you know, in topological insulator, usually people know that you have the spin, for surface space, you have the spin momentum locking. That's the spin is locked with the momentum. But by using our laser RFS, actually, we also observe that actually there's another phenomenon for the spin orbital locking. Just actually, you have two piece space spin, about orbitals. The orbital and spin are also locked. So this is phenomenon just predicted by Shouchen Zhang and other people. But actually, we can prove this phenomenon by using this spin RFS system. And then another system, just we call this the VV laser 2D momentum RFS. But because when we have shine light on sample, We already have a 2D solid space, a solid angle electrons already there. But for a long time, when we use this kind of analyzer, we only select a slice, only one line of angles to collect. So even though we have 2D Brillouin zone, every time actually we cut only one line. But all the others are lost. The signal are there, but they are not measured. So for a long time, people think whether it's possible to really collect one time, not just one line, just one area, one sort of angle. So that's the latest development. Just some company can develop this new analyzer by using the time of the electrons probably from the sample to the detector, but in the time to measure energy, then they use a 2D detector to measure those Kx and Y, the 2D wave. So in this way, actually now, people can really measure one area at one time. So previously only one line. So in this case, then if you use this area, compared with one line, actually this efficiency is improved by more than 200 times. So this is just a noise with this new technique. Actually, people can see the Fermi surface in the time. Just by we do the development, you already see the Fermi surface. But in the previously, people cannot do that. Previously, you can only see one band at one time, then you put all the bands together to form the Fermi surface. But now you can really see the Fermi surface, like with physical 212, and with antimony 111 surface space. It's a very small Fermi surface, several. You already can see it on the screen. So this is the latest development. I just want to show you this probably if you have some good idea, I can, maybe we can collaborate to do this. Okay. Then I just want to introduce the first work we did use this in the laser test, just the neural gap and the insulator signal transition in maximum dose SP212. And this work is mainly done by my student, Yin Peng, and also with a lot of discussion with many other theorists, particularly also DK Li from Taiwan. And she's now in Italy, working with Gary Perry and Briggs, yeah, his postdoc. So mainly, as you already heard in last many days, now for Kupferit supernatants, people are really working on this region a lot. Okay, mainly the pseudogap region, undergap region. And for a long time, people didn't work much on this region, just how this from this insulator, the signal transition, this region. And particularly for RFS, so far there's not much RFS work to really study how the insulator can transform into supernatural in this region. So that's why we want to jump in to study on this region. And we choose one system called the Nelson-Dope system 2101. Now this system is good because first it has the only one corpuscle layer within one cell. It has a simple crystal structure. Also, this system is good compared with 2-1-2. It is good because by using Nelson doping or use oxygen annealing, you can really cover the whole region, whole doping region, from undoped to open doped, overdoped. Okay, cover the whole region. This is a very good system. Also, further one is that because this system, even the highest TC here is about 34 Kelvin. So it's still relatively low. You can easily measure, study the normal state and signal state without a lot of thermal broadening. So that's why I think this system is good in this a few aspects. And then we just prepared as a sample in our lab ourselves, and we drew the sample and also annealed to get a different TC. This way we can cover the whole region, okay, in our lab. Okay, so mainly, I think in this work, I mainly want to work on this region, just from the antiferromagnetic insulator to the superconductor region. Also, for the Nelson dope physical loop 01, it is the phase diagram is a little bit special. It's a little bit different from others. Because for others, usually what we see is that you have an antiferromagnetic region, you have a super region. In the middle, there's a separation somewhere in the middle. But somehow, for this system, not to the one. This is at 0.10, actually this is the point where you have this insulator to see the transition. You don't see this in the middle of some middle in the middle region. You don't see it. So we first measured this the resistivity as function temperature for several typical samples. The stoking level is 0.03, you have the insulating sample. If you have 0.04, it's still insulating. But if you have 0.08, it's still insulating. But for the high temperature part, already have some flux resistivity. But when you go to 10%, you start to see superconductivity. And if you go to 10.5%, you can see like a TCRT even higher. So basically, you can see there's just not change with the doping. And we find that below 10% doping, we have insulator. Okay? And above 10%, we have the superconductor. So from the. That means from the. Directly from the transport measurement, we already see this the insulator for two similar position here.
There's a huge difference in high temperature and small
feed
larger
feed.
If you go to even higher temperature, do you see a temperature when
you
start merging and you see continuous evolution
as a function
of protein? Is this part? Yeah, if you consider 8% green line and 10% red line.
Yes.
They differ enormously and keep differing larger and larger when you increase temperature.
Yes.
So is there a temperature when they start coming together and, or you keep increasing temperature and with 8% and 10% you see larger and larger difference?
Well, it doesn't measure. I don't know, yeah. And there's some other features for LSAO, they measure up to very high temperature, maybe 800 Kelvin, even higher there. There's some other data. I don't have data here.
So the red and purple curves are not divided by 30 and the others are?
That's right. Yeah, only this one is divided by 30. This one by 30.
Magnitude may not be that.
Yeah, this one 30. This one, this are really not.
I see.
Yeah. Okay. That's right. Because these three are divided by 30. This are really not.
But still, even with divided division, there is still.
Well, the temperature dependence is quite different. Maybe the 80% is not so different in value and appropriate temperature from the 2%. I can't tell if that's 30.
Yeah.
So then we come to the later advanced measurement. We just first do the Fermi-Sims mapping. Actually, you can see that even for 3% doping, you already can see some underlying temperature. Mainly, you have a strong intensity contour here already. 3%, 5.5%, 8%, 10%. Okay. Then we just get this the underlying temperature, get the EDC. Okay. Then we get it along the Fermi surface, underlying temperature, we get all the EDC here. For human token, okay.
What's the temperature?
Temperature here is about 20 Kelvin. Yeah. So with the, all metals are coming within about 20 Kelvin.
You're in the initial gas?
I would talk about this arm. Because in this charge difference, of course, in the city gas, it's well below city gas. Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. So then, because usually, if people want to see whether you have the gas opening, people like to use the simplified CDC. In that case, if you see a dip, you see a gap. If you don't see a dip, you don't see a gap. So we just simplify this. You can see in 3%, of course you have a gap. If you go to 5.5%, you still have a gap. You have a dip here. This is the EDC along the Fermi surface already. This one, 8%, you still have a gap. But when you go to 10%, actually you don't see a gap. Okay. That really means just below 10% for this region, actually the whole Fermi surface, Fermi surface, entire Fermi surface is gap. Only till 10%, you don't see a gap here. Okay.
But it would still be gap in the antinode, or
all the areas. Even yes, right, that's right. You go from nodal to antinodal, they are all gaps.
Yeah.
Entire Fermi surface gap.
In 10% case, if you go to the antinode, you still have a.
Even if you look here, it's also gap. Yes, you have still gap here. Yes, but I mean in the nodal region, it's not a gap.
Well, at 3%, like it looks like a node, but it's not. It's a gap.
That's right. But the gap actually, you can see. That's strange. Even for 3%, you can still see something like Fermi surface. Okay. But if you do a cut here, you can actually they really have a gap. Even for 5% to 5%. But you still, even for this such a node opening, you still have this something like a Fermi surface. There's something peculiar here. Then the
gap, you mean what? If you look at
the same data. Yeah, let's look at the gap here. Just you have red one, you have this, you have dip. The gap size will be decided by only this transition point.
You mean that when the
deep
grows up and...
Yeah, this one even clearer. The gap size would be determined by this two peak.
Yes, sure.
Distance, the two data. Here you have the step, yeah, not well defined peak. But here it's very clear, because this is the distance between the two peaks, just like a scale. Okay. Then we want to just look at this middle direction to see how it evolves with the doping. Okay. So this is just a data. Now we have the double cuts, only cut on the node loop and at different doping level. You can really see when the doping level is low, to which extent, mainly the spread weight is at some high energy. When you increase the doping, after the weight was gradually transferred to some low energy, eventually it gets very strong at the level. Here it gets weaker. So you can see that just the spectral transfer from high energy to low energy. Okay. Also, if you look at the EDC after the turning momentum, I put it here, just a different token. If you have 3%, actually you don't see any quasi-particle peak in the Fermi level. If you go to 4%, already you can see something from the level. Go to 5.5%, you can see more. If you go to 7%, you already see a peak. So even for 7% on another direction, you already see a clear peak here. Of course, here if you go to even higher, 8%, 10%, go to 10.5, you can see a very sharp peak already. So this is just the evolution of the nodal direction that you can see as a function of doping. Of course, you can also simplify this to see whether the gap opening. For 3%, basically you cannot define the gap size, because if they appear, the weight is small. If you go to 4%, you can really define the gap size, 5.5, 7, 7%, and 8%, 10%. You can really see, on a middle direction, the gap is getting smaller with increasing doping. Here, 10.5% is become zero. Okay, this is basically the message you can see from the node direction, this band structure and also EDC. So also we want to find out whether this the node kink, node gap can disappear or not if we increase the temperature. So we just choose one just sample, and the node gap we take the temperature dependence. And actually you can see even if we go to 300 Kelvin, we can still see suppression of spread weights. Okay, well, another direction. It looks like the gap is still persists, can persist to very high temperature. So then, mainly, if we look at this carefully out of this EDC along another direction, mainly we can see two things. Just for any given EDC spectrum, we can see one peak and also one hump. Just all the peak here, hump here. We have two basic features here, okay. And at low doping, you have a hump is very obvious. When you increase doping, the hump gets weaker and weaker. The peak gets stronger and stronger. Basically, we have two features in ADC. So we want to really look at this the evolution, momentum evolution of these two features. Okay, just one peak. The peak. We want to see how if we go from along the surface from no direction to any direction, how this peak position. A gap evolves with the momentum. So this is for 4%, we can see the minute peak vision, the gap size, the gap size with the function of momentum this way, 5.5 and 7 and 8 and 10. This is basically the gap size as function of momentum for different tokens. Okay. And if you, actually, we find that it's very strange, it's very interesting. Of course, in this case, the whole function of the stoke is a gap. The gap is smallest in another direction, but gets larger when you go to the end direction. Okay. And this gap as function of momentum, actually, we can it looks like a keyword line, but it was the constant, which was constant. Okay. Mainly you can see that it's offset by the little gap, then you see it's a keyword like form, this is the little gap. Also, if we look at the comp structure also has a function momentum. It also shows something like D-wave line. Okay. And also, it's a D-wave line plus some constant at the middle direction. So basically, the comp and the gap, we have the similar form. And basically, it's just the D-wave form plus the constant. That's something we can observe.
Is the ratio of each node of a data node from the data to commit traffic?
That one, I didn't do that yet. I can easily get it out of here from here. But I didn't.
On the material level, whether it's 3-day effect, which you see.
Yeah, that one, that's easy to find out. I didn't do that here. Then this is strange. It's very strange. It's this gap is a single form, but offset by a constant, that's another gap. So, and actually, the little gap is not just observed in our system, in Lexman 2201, but it was already reported before, even in 2212. But in this case, this is from the exchange group. In this case, after they observe the little gap actually for the signal sample. In this signal dome, and for the heavily enveloped sample, the sample is still nothing, you can also see a good little gap. But in this case, the sample is 22 Kelvin PC, but for 26 Kelvin, we can still see a little gap in this gap. Okay. For this sample, the PC is 34 Kelvin, but in the 41 Kelvin measurement, no reduction, still see gap. So in this case, in fiscal 1, I think 1-2, actually they see the little gap for the heavily enveloped sample, but these samples are still significant. But this is different from our case. For our case, we really see the gap only in the significant sample, not in the significant sample. Okay. And for this case, it's also not very consistent with the transport measurements, because if we look here, actually, for the sample, we measured here. Actually, if you look at this, the resistance actually is a measure of metallic behavior. Okay. But we can see a little gap. So I don't know how to reconcile with this too. Because the resistance is a mechanic, but you can see the whole resistance gap in the case. Also, the same case is for the LSL. And another group measured this LSL system, and the TC is about 20 Kelvin. And we can also see another gap here. Okay, another direction after this gap, and it also can change the temperature. Okay. And the same thing that for this particular sample, 8% doping LCL, if you look at this resistivity, temperature dependence 8%, actually it's also good metal. Somehow for these two measurements, so we can see the little gap, we can see this, we can see the full gap from the surface, even when the sample actually shows mechanic behavior from transport measurements. Yes.
Is it interesting enough to distinguish between constant plus E wave or square root of constant square plus E wave square?
That one we cannot tell you. Yeah. Just this model, our data is not good enough to really tell that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Just looks like that. Yes. Yeah. So this, but for our case, really we can see, we can really see have good correspondence between the output measurement and also the transport measurement. If the transport measurement gives us the insulator, we see another gap, the full gap between the surface. If the transport measurement gives us significant activity, and we don't see the gap. So we have a good correspondence in our measurement, but somehow for the previous instrument 1-2 and also LSTO, there's some controversy between the transport measurement and output measurement.
That's sorry, right. That went by very fast for my slow brain. Can you just say it one more time? So fully gapped, insulating, superconducting nodal gap.
No. Yeah.
No.
That's what I wanted to be sure on.
No nodal gap.
No nodal gap for superconducting.
No nodal gap.
No, that's not right. No, I mean, okay, in this region, A region, above TC, there is a nodal gap. Here. This sample, this is still and the dome.
In the green region above.
In the green region. Region.
When you raise the temperature, you see a nodal gap.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's so cool here. Just the below TC, above TC, the gap's still there. There's no difference. There's still two gaps there. Okay, these two curves, one is below TC, 10 Kelvin, the red one, the other one is above TC, 26 Kelvin. In both cases, you can see a gap.
Okay.
But it's above TC, there is a nodal gap.
And where does the gapless superconductor develop in your phase diagram?
I guess in your case, the superconductor, there is no gap.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. In my case, I can only see the little gap when the sample is insulating heat on this side.
Okay.
If somebody becomes nothing, I don't see you do that.
But in a 2212 case, yeah, you still see another gap in the fluid gap phase on higher doping?
That one actually, they only see a little gap in A region, in this small region. Okay. Yeah, that's why they divided this dome into three
regions. I'm having problems with the word nodal gap.
Yeah.
It's a misnomer.
It means that
you've got a gap and a node, right?
No, it just means the direction.
It's a node, yeah. Node.
Sure, it's along the direction where the other guys have a node. But it's not a very good term.
Okay. Well, but it's just the gap along the diagonal direction.
Okay.
Diagonal gap.
It should be called
a diagonal gap
would be a better word. Right?
Okay.
Of diagonal long range order?
Yeah.
Is there any indication in your paper that there is this tiny region of great Wilson placements in the field and sort of the or they just one disappears in the second immediately?
I will talk about this later on. Okay. Yeah. Actually, this is very, very peculiar in this field to the one. Yeah. Mainly, this is mainly the results. Mainly we see this PKT form structure, and also this is the just the special weight transfer with the doping level. Also we see this gear-like gap and offset by the nodal gap. Yeah, this is one. And particularly, this is diagram. Mainly NMR can measure this the antiferromagnetic near temperature. And they also find that at 10%, okay, near temperature becomes zero. The 10% is the point where your near temperature becomes zero from here about 300,000 go to zero. And also it is the point where just the middle gap becomes zero. Okay. Also it's the point where your supernivity starts to appear. Okay. At some point the 10% just three things happen at the same point. And particularly this antiferromagnetism also with its near temperature at zero at this point. So somehow these three things are closely related with each other in the system. So I think because that the origin of this little gap, of course, the whole Fermi space gaps, are still open. We don't quite know exactly how we can produce this gap. But there have been a lot of discussions on the origin of the gap, and some. In our case, we just discussed whether this is strong enough to form coupling in hybrid endotope sample, and also if you have antiferromagnetism, you may enhance the endotope coupling, and give you some strong polaronic effect. So that we discussed whether this strong polaronic effect can give us some little gap. But some other people like Maurice Weiss, like Fu-Jun Zhang, they are working on this disorder, some Anderson localization. Picture. Also, Zhong Hai Li and other people, we just see whether this even in the hybrid endotope region, you still have the superconductor, but embedded in the antiferromagnetic background, so that can give you some even topological superconductor. Also, some other discussions are still going on. And we, yeah.
Sorry,
yeah.
Is there any optical measurement of the gap?
Yeah, there is. Actually, there is optical measurement paper, and which has a system with our measurements. It's also some.
The optical gap is similar.
I don't remember the gap size, but the optical measurement also indicates there is a transition of 10% from insulator to the supernatural. That's the system. And I don't know exactly the gap size.
And the question is the antiferromagnetic insulator a commensurate or incommensurate antiferromagnet?
This one, there's no neutron measurements. This one, this with a near temperature is input from the NMR measurements. I don't know whether NMR measures really
in local population.
I don't know whether it's commensurate or incommensurate. But there's no neutron measurements. Yeah.
Is the sample big enough for neutron?
And if we work hard, we can get it to
scale.
Yeah.
Very issue.
Yeah. Mm. It takes a lot of effort to really grow a lot of samples.
Mm.
Yeah.
Is it known that the system is at least electronically uniform by NMR or something in these low dopings? Could it be not
we are working with the Yayu Wang in Tsinghua University on SPM. It's not so homogeneous. If we go to habitat nodes, the sample is not so homogeneous. Mm. It's not.
But you can imagine when you study transport, that can be very. You're close to the Mott transmission, it's low doping.
So that's right. That's right.
Can be some phase separation.
So mainly, I think it's just, of course, that the little gap is definitely not the water gap. It's something else.
So,
yes.
On this issue, you know, there was this office that are going from the antinodal direction towards the node by cuts in the bismuth 2201.
Yes.
Did you try to? And they saw that the energy state were coming from below the Fermi level. But it was just cuts at the antinodal directions, and then going lower.
That's the one we are going to repeat that one.
Okay.
We're going to
because it seems that you have a good resolution.
Yes. We're going to repeat that experiment. Those on 2201 or 2122.
I see.
Yes, that's in our plan to do that. We also use the 2D system, really one shot already.
They claim they have evidence for the 2201 of this charge order vector.
Yeah.
In the antinodal region, that the gap.
We did this measurement before, but we didn't see the similar phenomenon as projections group observed.
Mm.
So that's why we want to repeat again. Yeah, that one, we need to repeat again. There's some complications there. Anyway, I think this is the question on origin of the middle gap. This is the whole gap, the whole series gap. So I think it's still open. I hope you can find it interesting to just work on this. Yeah. Then, I'll move to the next topic, just the nodal and nodal kink evolution. So this work is done by my former students, Jiufeng He, and he's now a postdoc in Boston College. And mainly, because RFS is good in that it not only measures the span structure from the surface, actually it can become a very powerful tool to really measure many body effects. That's how electrons can interact with other electrons, with the four lungs, with manganese, minerals, and stuff. That's why I think particularly with the advancement of the energy revolution, I think it really becomes very, very powerful. If this, self-energy, we can really measure just how electrons interact with other intermediates, disorder, phonons, magnons, etc. Okay. Mainly the manifestation is that if you have free electron, you have the parabola band. Now if you turn on the electron coupling, you will see that the band will just be normalized near the Fermi level. And also from this, you can get the electron phonon coupling constants, also the phonon energy, etc. So this has been proven very early in 2000 by measuring on this very typical strong electron phonon coupling system, beryllium 001. When you really see the dispersion wise, you can see a kink on the dispersion, and that gives you the phonon energy. Also, scattering rates can show a very steep drop, also giving you the phonon energy. So this has been proven. That's why by the year 2000, when I was still working in Berkeley and Stanford, we observed first time the another direction, we see another kink in the system to the 1-2 at the time. At that time, even the data is the best at that time, but still not good enough. But you can see by carefully analyzing, you can see a kink at 70 millimole at the time. Okay. But then, from later on, there's a lot of work on this direction. Mainly to really investigate where the kink, how the kink just evolves with the doping, with the temperature, with different systems. Okay, so this is different doping. We have covered the whole doping from 0.3% to over 30% in our system. Also, in many different temperatures from our systems. Eventually, I think it is that the kink, the 70 millimole kink, along the direction, is present in various materials we measure, also at the various dopings. Also about this PWTC. It means very ubiquitous. It's everywhere. Of course, there is a debate on the origin of the 70 millibar kink, even to here today, whether it is electronic coupling with some phonon or magnetic mode. Okay, so far, I think still not settled yet. But later on, after this, we also did one more experiment to really work on this problem. We just choose one sample, a Christmas to do one sample. We can make it very, very heavily overdosed, almost to the point that it's not superconductive. In this case, actually, the doping number is very high, but maybe 28-27% already on this region. So this is a heavily overdosed sample. In this case, I would expect that the magnetic signal should be weak. Okay. Also, if there is magnetic resonance, it's because the frequency, its energy is proportional to C. The frequency will already become zero. But even for this sample, if we do a careful measurement, this is raw data. If we do a careful measurement, you can see a very strong, very clear 70 millibar little kink. Okay. So this experiment is just really prompts me that to think that very darkly, along the middle direction, the 70 millibar kink is really from the electron coupling with phonon. Okay. In this case, it's hard for me to imagine we still have very strong magnetic resonance mode here. There's nothing like that here. Okay. Also, this is the generative kink. Another famous kink is called the engineered kink. It's by measuring along the engineered reaction direction, this direction. You can also see a kink. The normal state is two bands. When you pull down, it forms a kink structure here. Okay. This kink is at the 40 millibar at the end of the region.
You call it kink or
backward dispersion? We call this, if you have a dispersion, if you have a break, slope to break. You have different slope, at a point, we call it a kink.
Did you see also backward dispersion with
the one that can do that? Actually, we can see that. Yeah. So this is another famous kink, identical kink. Still also, the origin is still not clear. Some people argue this is due to the magnetic mode by Pandasov group. Also later on by the exchange group, they proposed that this is still the electron coupling, but the electron coupling with the E1G phonon, that's the oxygen vibration and the C reaction, E1G phonon. It can also interpret this. But for a long time, okay, mainly we have two kinds of kinks. One is double direction kink, the other one is any other kink. We have only two groups of measurements under this region. But this long time question is that how this little kink, 70 millibar kink, can evolve to the 40 millibar kink? Whether there's only one kink, we just gradually evolve from 70 to 40, or some other case. So actually, this is in the middle. For long time, we don't know how it can go from 70 to 40. We don't know this. But recently just by using laser tests, actually, we can gain some just insight on this problem. Mainly, we measure on some little bit of overdose sample. By using laser tests, we can see very clearly. In this case, actually, if you have a measurement somewhere between the and the reaction, actually, if you do second derivative, you can see from raw data, actually, there are two kinks, two transitions here. One here, the one also one here. So from the raw data, actually, we already see there are two kinks in the data. If you do EDC, actually, on the EDC, you can see two peak dip pump. Two peak dip pump structures. Okay. If you do qualitative analysis of this self-energy, real-world self-energy, you can also see some module features. Basically, in this case, actually, by using these aspects, if we have some good resolution, actually, we can really see there are two peaks, two energy scales already coexisting for any cat. Okay, this is just then we can move the momentum. Actually, even if we move from low direction, all the way to the end direction, you can really see that these two energy scales are there for all the number of cuts. That's for no direction, all the way to the end direction. You can see the lower, high energy one and low energy one. You can see they are coexisting across all the momentum space. And from this, we can use EDC self-derivative with a tip to measure the energy. Okay, I use also use the self-energy, local self-energy. Let's took the two peak position to measure energy. We can see this two scale, one is high energy scale, little scale as function of the momentum by using the middle direction to another direction. We can see this one, high energy one, this one, this lead, it keeps at the 7 to 8 millivolt from nodal to any nodal, doesn't change much. But for low energy one, this one, we can, if you go from the nodal direction, it's about 68 millivolt in nodal direction, and gradually decreases to about 40 millivolt to the nodal direction. So basically you have two modes coexisting. One doesn't change much, the other one can change dramatically from the 68 to 40 millivolt when we go from the nodal and the nodal direction. So also we can get the temperature dependence to see how these two modes evolve with temperature. We will catch another direction somewhere in the middle and another one near to the nodal direction. And also look at the real part of self-energy as function of temperature. Mainly for the nodal direction, we mainly see this the overall 70 millivolt, but it's broad, actually it's composed of two. Even on another direction, we have two, one 78, the other one 68, but they are close. Actually, we don't see much change with temperature. But when we go to here, at the region, we can see this lower is pink. Just the below TC it develops, above TC it disappears. So 70 millivolt pink is present above TC. But 40 millivolt pink, it only develops below TC. Okay, that's basically we can see from our measurements. Okay. Then also we measure our different samples. We have different overdose 782 samples, Kelvin, open dopes, and also underdopes. We measure different samples. Okay. Eventually we put this, put all the data here in this figure. Mainly we see for different samples, we see two under scales, and one just the higher one doesn't change much with the momentum. The lower one just changes from the 70 to 40 with the momentum. So this is basically what we see. I think this observation first answers the question how they just little pink evolves into the little pink. Basically, we have actually the two modes are coexisting. Yes, on all premises, we always have two modes together. Just one node doesn't change much. The other one just changes from 70 to 640. Here, people always say 70 millivolt, because they actually they are two. One 78, the other one 68, and they are close. They're very close, but some people just overall say, oh, we have 70 millivolt pink on another direction. Okay. But the 40 millivolt, actually this one is strong compared with this one. Actually, we still see this one 40 millivolt pink. But actually we have two modes that are fully existing in this case. I think that's how we solve the issue of the evolution between this nodal and the nodal pink. And actually we have some problem to understand the origin of this two modes. But it's already spectacular to see some sharp modes developed in the human state. We can really see sharp modes. But then what is the nature of the two and the modes and the scales? After we spend a long time, even till now, we cannot understand because there's some contours. We always cannot get a consistent picture to understand these two modes. The reason is like this. Because first, we want to assign these two modes as formal. We did a very simple simulation. We cannot do two kinds of things. We just use for the two phonon, one is 50 millivolt, the other one is 80 millivolt, and the simulator is actually omega. And we will take this one as data to analyze the second derivative, to get EDC. From EDC, you can really see some two decomp structure. Also, from the real part of self-energy, you can really see two peaks, because we put the two phonons in it. We want to compare this simulation with our measurements. And if you look at this one, this is the analytical second derivative for different samples, the simulated one. Actually, you can see they are quite similar. Even some details are quite similar. Looks like if I put the two phonons there, I can see this data quite well. Because looking from here, all the details are quite similar.
Without temperature dependence,
right. This one, we just put zero temperature. Simulation. But then I have a problem. Not from here, it looks like I can understand my data, but I have a problem. One problem is that It's a downtown problem, actually, for 4-5-DC. Just we know if we have a mode coupling in a normal state, we go to signal state, actually the mode should be shifted by the gap. Okay. In the S-wave semiconductor, the coupling is easy. You have only one gap. In the D-wave, you have the momentum dependent gap. But I think Attack and also some Dick already showed that if you have D-wave semiconductor, even you measure along those direction, the gap is zero there. Actually, above the TC normal state, you have the mode here. When you go to signal state, even along those direction, your mode should be still pushed to the original mode plus maximum data. That's the case. Okay. That means if we measure the measurements on another direction, if the hubble mode coupling in normal space, if I go to extreme signal states, my mode should be shifted to original omega plus data. But we never see this. I spent a long time trying to find this literature, but I never see this shifting. Because if this is 212, the gap is big, 30 millivolt. So originally, normal state have 70 millivolt kink. In the signal state, I should have 100 millivolt. But 100 millivolt is usually big. I never see shifting of this phenomenon. So somehow this picture is not consistent with our measurements. Okay, if we think that 70 millivolt kink is due to phonon coupling. Okay. So that's basically what I said before. Here, basically, the 70 millivolt kink above TC, below TC, you don't see a big shift of the 30 millivolt maximum gap. Okay. And later on, I think there's another picture just proposed, put forth by this colleague and others, also by Tom Devereaux in Stanford. They just say, okay, I can solve this problem. In the previous picture, they say you're not coupling with phonon, it's an isotropic scattering stuff. Yeah. But in this case, they say, okay, I can put in the full scattering phonon. Okay. So in this case, in this picture, so then if you go to, if you have a mode in normal space, or sigma, so you go to similar states, the extra data here will be local data. It's not the data zero. So in this case, if we go to local direction, local data is zero. So that means you can understand why, by using this picture, why in local direction, above TC, below TC, there's no shift of the frequency because of local data. And this can only explain the data along local direction. But if you can move away, you still cannot understand. Because for this one is already momentum dependence. If I have a mode of 70 in normal states, even if I put the local gap here, I should get the gap, get this one go up from 0, 70 to eventually 100, because by adding the gap. Okay. For this one is even more dramatic. Instead of, if I should start from 68 millivolt, by adding local gap, I should also go up. Actually, it's going down. So it looks like we really cannot understand the momentum evolution of these two modes. Okay, if we just simply interpret as the electron coupling with phonon so far. But it looks like this, some strong evidence show actually in normal states we really have the electron phonon coupling. But still we can understand why it doesn't go up in this case. So that's why I think we still have this is the puzzle. We have been traveling for a long time, but still we need to have answers.
What if you try to associate the flow and what's with magnetic resonance?
Sorry?
If you separate, say, 70 or 75 MeV, global kink is due to phonon, while what you see in antinodal region is due to magnetic resonance.
I think at present I don't have a consistent picture. You want to say this is phonon, they go to the magnetic node?
No, I'm not saying that you have two resonances even on diagonal direction.
Yes, so no, I'm quite.
To say that one is phonon and another is
what was magnetic resonance
in antinodal region, it evolves into another region, loses intensity, etc.
The problem for me is that no matter what it is, no matter it's phonon or any mode, but if you just from normal state to sigma state, actually any mode coupling, you should add up with the gap phi.
Do you see two modes along nodal direction in the normal state?
That one we cannot tell because it's too very broad.
We cannot. You cannot say that one mode will not disappear about
That's the, I think, overall. This is the nodal direction, yeah. What we can see, yeah. You see, we can still see there are two modes here, but they are very close in energy.
Okay. I think that about PC, you can see.
About PC, we still have, yeah, this, even, yeah, of course, here we have peak, here we have a step, but even this strong, excuse me, strong indication here, we have something.
Yeah. Right, there is definitely more there. Yeah, the question is, are there two or one?
I think we just, here I cannot tell, but if we could move a little bit away, you can already see two already. Yeah.
To what extent could impurity forward scattering be affecting this? Impurity forward scattering. I have this memory that maybe we talk about it later, but yeah. That somehow as you go to the antinodal region, if you had impurity forward scattering, you get a remarkable sharpness of the response of the gap, or you might have thought it was blurred by the impurities, but because of the forward scattering, they act more like S-wave, and you get a sharpness. For some reason, I thought in one of your papers you discussed what I think was the red line on the right-hand one. Yeah. The red line, the peak evolved there as somehow reflecting this forward impurity scale.
That's another paper. That okay. paper, we discussed the ultra-low energy kink, the 7 millibar kink.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a very low energy scale. It's 10 to 7 millibar to 10 millibar.
Okay.
That's ultra-low affinity kink. That's the one. People thought at the beginning, the sense group from Dazzler, they thought it's from the optical corner.
Right.
But from our analysis, I think it's due to impurity.
Right.
Yeah. That's not by impurity, you can understand that. Okay. Yeah.
Sorry, from the same question, but for any direction, whether yeah. it's nodal or antinodal,
yeah.
do you have situation that's about PC in a normal state, you can still see two things?
Basically, you can see from this is basically this is the picture. You can see from nodal direction, other three different cuts here, right? You can see also because it contains different temperatures. Mainly, as I said, if you go to about to see, mainly this lower energy one will disappear.
Right, and I'm asking whether it can follow this low energy one
yeah.
and track it a little bit away from anti-nodal direction. Is there any way to see whether this
still
disappears at PC?
This is away from an intersection.
This
is only yeah. This is away from the intersection. Yeah.
That's natural to associate this with something. Energy is right, temperature dependence is right.
But can magnetic nodes has energy here around the 60?
Yes,
I think we can discuss.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mainly, I can just pose some challenges from our present understanding. Because I cannot understand if I have two sharp modes coupling, if I go from normal state to different states, mm-hmm. just that the trend is just the opposite to my expectation here this way. Yeah. So if you no matter whether you add the constant gap size or just the local size, you should go up this way. Then go up this way or stay constant. That's something I don't want to understand. Yes. Okay. I think that's all for my talk today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Not there, let's take that.
Okay.